joining the cheer.
I got permission, son.
Okay, so we'll talk afterwards or later?
Yes, in half an hour.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry, I'm late and I have to leave early, so just have a very short cheer today, but I wanted to have something. This is reminiscent of a famous mice, actually, you know, where we saw Salanter's Talmud Mufak was Rav Simcha Zissel, who was known as the Elder of Kelim, the old man of Kelim. And he started the yeshiva, and the yeshiva was mainly, people don't realize, the Kelim in Kelim, it was mainly for young boys. It was not, you know, it was like a high school, really. Besides being a regular yeshiva, there was a tremendous emphasis on the formation of character, the formation of midos, and the building up of all sorts of inner discipline. The altar of Kelim Shita Bechlau was that a person has to have control over every aspect of his life. So in Kelim, there were different minhagim, that if you got a package of food from your parents, which in Europe was a very big deal, you had to share it with everybody. You couldn't keep the food for yourself. If you got a letter from your parents or somebody, you could not open it for 24 hours. Because you don't have to be like an animal, you know. After a fast...
I knew that was the next words.
After a fast, the minhag was they would give fish with a lot of little bones in it. Yeah, because what's the pshat? Because after a fast, a person eats, says, oh, you have to eat lot. So the whole idea of Kelim, so Yaakov Kamenetsky, oh yeah, I'll tell you another story about Kelim. There's so many stories about the kind of the discipline that was in Kelim. And this was, you know, to train young people to be in control of themselves. They're not just Hefker. So in Kelim, there was a person who was in charge. If you came late to davening, whatever, you would get fined, you know, different things. So one of the things you couldn't do in Kelim is that you couldn't look around during davening. You looked around, whatever it is. So Yaakov Kamenetsky came to Kelim as a young bacher to spend some time. And he recounts this story. So the first time he was there, the gabbai thought there was no Kohen, so he was about to call up the Yisrael. So Rav Yaakov noticed that just when they were about to call him up, a Kohen went in, so he went to the gabbai and said, a Kohen just came in. So the gabbai said, Yasher Koach, but he fined him, because he said, you shouldn't be looking around. So at the same time. Actually, the Havdol is reminiscent, I may have mentioned the story, but in Harvard University had... in colonial times, even as it has today, the largest library in North America in terms of books and everything else. So there was a massive fire in the 1600s. The whole library got burnt down. Nothing survived. So there was a student who had stolen a book without checking it out. And everyone was heartbroken because the library was destroyed. Books were not so easy to replace today then as they are today. So he goes back to the librarian. He says, you know, Baruch Hashem, I've saved one remnant. There's one book here. So they gave him a reward, and they expelled him from the school. So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky said about Kelim, he says, Kelim's a wonderful place. Every person should go there for at least 6 months. But then he said, but no more. He says, 6 months. So the reason I'm bringing up Kelim, actually, is I'm using up my shirt time, but it's good to give this much. The reason I mentioned Kelim is because one of the hanagas of Kelim was to teach people the value of time. So as a result, there was a takana that there was a 5-minute learning seder in the middle of the night. And there had to be 5 minutes. No more and no less. Now that's important because when you have a 5-minute learning seder, you cannot come that late to it. Person has 5 hours, 5 minutes late, what's the big deal? And that was the idea that, you know, they allocated, let's say, whatever it is, 5 or 10 minutes to get dressed, probably maybe less than 5 minutes to get dressed. And then you had to be in the Beis Medrash for 5 minutes and then go back. So we're having today the equivalent maybe of a relatively short cheer. So yesterday we were talking about the idea of Yitzias, or Monday talking about Yitzias Mitzrayim. And we were looking at it halachically, that there's actually a daily mitzvah, which is twice a day, to remember verbally, not just in your mind, to remember verbally Yitzias Mitzrayim, right? And the Art School Siddur tells us this, because when you say in Kriya Shema, Ani Hashem Elokeichem, I am Hashem that took you out of Mitzrayim, you should have specific kavana to want to fulfill the commandment to remember the Exodus. Now, if you recall from our discussion of the Mishnah and your memory of the Haggadah, there is indeed a machlokes whether we will mention this mitzvah when Mashiach comes. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah has a drasha that's from the extra words, kol yemei chayecha, we are marbe, you even do it at night, even though we didn't go out of Mitzrayim at night. And we don't mention it, limos of Mashiach. The Chachamim say we do mention it, even limos of Mashiach. So if you look in the Gemara in Brachos, the Gemara in Brachos says that actually they are disagreeing about a verse in the Navi Yirmiyahu, whether we will mention Yetzias Mitzrayim limos of Mashiach. The Navi Yirmiyahu was, of course, the great Navi of the Chorban Beis HaMikdash. He lived at the Chorban. He experienced personally the Chorban Beis HaMikdash. He wrote Megillas Eicha, Lamentations. But in one of the psukim of comfort that he was given, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, Hey Yamin Boim. It's a pasuk in Yirmiyahu. Hina Yamin Boim. Behold, days are coming. Niyum Hashem, says Hashem. Shelo Yomar Od. They shall no longer say, Chai Hashem, by the life of Hashem, Asher Hotzi Eschem Mitzrayim, took you out of Mitzrayim. Instead, they will talk about Hashem gathering the dispersed of Israel from the Dalit Kanfos Ha'aretz. So Ben Zoma says quite logically, of course, now this pasuk is talking about Mashiach, when Mashiach comes. Of course, we're not going to mention Yetzias Mitzrayim when Mashiach comes, because the pasuk says there will come a day when we will no longer say, Baruch Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim, because the future Geula is going to be so much greater, miracles even greater than Eretz Mitzrayim, that we're not even going to remember that Exodus. As the Gemara gives a mashal, if somebody gave you silver and then gave you gold, you know, you're not going to even mention the silver anymore. You got something much better. So Ben Zoma darshins the pasuk of Yirmiyahu as an indicator that we're not going to be maskir Yetzias Mimos Mashiach. How do the Chachamim deal with that pasuk? The Chachamim say that the Navi did not mean Yetzias Mitzrayim will be nullified legamri. It just means it will not be an ikar. The main mention will be about Mashiach, but we will still talk about Yetzias Mitzrayim because that was the precursor. And the Gemara discusses an analogy to this. When Hashem said about Yaakov Avinu, your name shall no longer be Yaakov, it shall be Yisrael. This is after he fought with the angel. And yet we do know that the Torah continues to refer to Yaakov as Yaakov. The answer is Yisrael is his main name and Yaakov is a secondary name. So the Chachamim interpret that the same thing is true for Yetzias Mitzrayim. So it turns out we do have a machlokes whether the mitzvah of Zechiras Yetzias Mitzrayim is going to be nullified Limos Mashiach, and that depends how we interpret the pasuk in Yirmiyahu. Does the pasuk in Yirmiyahu say Lo Yomar Od, they shall not mention it at all? Or does it mean it shall be a tafel, it shall be secondary to the Geula Vasida? Now it's interesting that the Ramban in Chumash uses this pasuk in Yirmiyahu for a very interesting point. You know that the names of the Jewish months, Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev, Teves, are not in the Torah. In fact, it's consistent. The Torah consistently only what are months called? First month, second month, Chodesh Arishon, Chodesh Hasheni. Moreover, the months are not even counted from Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah is not, Tishrei is not Chodesh Arishon. The Chodesh Arishon is Nisan. So when do we first see the names that we know them? Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev. So the Gemara actually says the names of the months are Babylonian in origin. They're not Jewish. And we simply lifted them from the Babylonians after the 70 years of exile, during the 70 years of exile, and we brought them back. That is why the first books of Tanakh, which use these names, are the books that date from the Babylonian exile. Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, Megillas Esther. And you'll notice, just like whenever you transition from one system to another system, you got to use both. Let's say you go over from the metric system or to the metric system. right? If America ever switches, like America's the last country in the world, Canada's under metric?
Okay.
So America might be the last country in the world that's not under the metric system, as far as I know. But if we ever switch, so it's going to say, you know, it'll say 55 miles and X number of kilometers, whatever it is. So too, in Megillas Esther, you'll notice every date is given in a double system. So it'll say Adar, it'll say that Haman wanted to kill the Jews in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Why does it use both? Because that's exactly the point at which we're moving from the number month to these new names. So the reader wouldn't necessarily know, so they give you both dates, so to speak. It's like metric and non-metric. So the Ramban, right, so this we know. This is the Gemara tells. The Gemara tells us Beferish, Shemos HaChadashim. The names of the months came from Babylonia. In fact, it's interesting, it'd be striking if you ever learned the Nabi Yecheskel. Yecheskel, who also lived during the time of the Churban, has a prophetic vision of the Jews in the Beis HaMikdash itself bowing down to idols. As if to say, while they're in the Beis HaMikdash, their heart is against Hashem. And it says they were bowing down to Tammuz. Now, which is strange. Tammuz, you mean the month? What do you mean they're bowing down? Tammuz was the name of a Babylonian idol. So not only is it a Babylonian term, it's a name. It's a name of Avodah Zarah. So the Ramban, right, asked the question, why did we lift Babylonian months? Like, what is the purpose of it? So listen to what he says. He says a very, very fascinating point. He says, we know that in Judaism, we also, just as we didn't have names for months, we also, to this day, we don't have names for days of the week. We don't have a Monday or whatever it is. Everything is first day, second day, third day. And why is that so? Because you're counting towards Shabbos. The first day, L'Shabbat, which means, we translate it to the week, but no. L'Shabbos means first day towards Shabbos, second day towards Shabbos, which is a little interesting because we often learn that Sunday, Monday, Tuesday belongs to the old, and that's why you could still make Havdalah. The Kedusha is from the old Shabbos. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday belongs to the new Shabbos. But nevertheless, in our counting, starting from Sunday, we're already counting to the new Shabbos. The Ramban says, why do we do it that way? Because one of the mitzvahs of the Torah, the fourth commandment in the Aseret HaDibros, is Zochor es Yom HaShabbos HaKadosh, remember the day of Shabbos to keep it holy. So every single day, we fulfill that mitzvah by remembering that Shabbos is coming up. So the Ramban says, the minyan of the days of the week is a fulfillment of remembering the day of Shabbos to keep it holy. In fact, in some Siddurim, not the art scroll, but some older Siddurim, they actually have, like, before you say the Shir Shel Yom, they say, Hinini Mechavein, Hinini Muchen Mezuman, I am preparing myself, L'kayim Es HaMitzvah, to fulfill the mitzvah, Zohar Es Yom HaShabbos L'Kadsho, Hayom Yom Rishon L'Shabbos, or B'Shabbos, etc. So the Ramban says, the same way the days of the week were designed to focus our mind on Shabbos and thereby fulfill the mitzvah every day, not just on Kiddush. Remember the day of Shabbos to keep it holy. So too the Torah envisioned that in our month dating, we would constantly be cognizant of Yetzias Mitzrayim. This is the first month, the month of our redemption, Nisan, Iyar. This is the second month, you know, the month after the month of our redemption. That every time you have a month date, any dating of a month, you're always thinking. Right? So Zakt Ramban like this. When the Jews were redeemed from Babel, even though it wasn't a complete redemption because they were still under Persian rule and the like, Chazal wanted to enact, or the Navi wanted to enact a remembrance that just like our dating system of the days of the week is designed to make us think of Shabbos, and our dating system of the months was designed to make us think of the Exodus, they wanted a dating system that would make us be Makir Tov, that Hashem took us out of Golus Bavel and brought us back to Eretz Yisrael. And since Yirmiyahu indicated, that should even supersede Yetzias Mitzrayim. Chazal saw this as a basis that in our months, when I talk about Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev, I actually think about the Golos of Bavel, which Hashem took us out. And so the Ramban uses Lo Yom Arayt as the basis that instead of focusing on Golos Mitzrayim, we focus on Golos Bavel. Now the only question is, of course, I mean, the problem is that the Lo Yom Arayt is referring to Yimosa Mashiach. But nevertheless, what's interesting is that theoretically, the Gemara says in Brachos, the Geula in the days of Ezra should have been a final Geula. Had we been Zeicha, after the 70 years, Ezra would have brought us back with miracles and Nisim, and that would have been Mashiach, and there wouldn't have been any other Golos, and that second Mikdash would have lasted forever. It was a Chaval, we were not Zeicha, so it turned into a very incomplete type of Golos. But maybe that's what Chazal are reminding us, by kind of memorializing that redemption with the type of designation that would be connected to Mashiach, changing the whole dating system. Maybe it's reminding us of missed opportunities, that a person has to know that yes, that could have been the Geula. We were not Zocha, and therefore a person has to look in life to recognize that Hashem gives us many, many opportunities. And when we don't take advantage of them, they dissipate and they don't turn into the redemptive possibilities that they could have turned into. This is what the Ramban says on Lo Yom Arayt, why we use the Shemos of those months. So that was one horror I wanted to share with you. Another horror, again, as I said, we're going to be very, very short today, is that the Ramban, again, it's also a Ramban, we're not given populations here. I mean, all we're told is that there were only 70 Jews who came to Mitzrayim, and that includes Yaakov. And as Rashi pointed out, if you count the number of people, you only have 69, not including Yaakov, that's the Machlokas. And the 70th person was Yocheved, Moshe Rabbeinu's mother, who was born as Levi, as her father was Levi, as they were entering Mitzrayim. So in a sense, she did not leave Eretz Yisrael, but she entered Mitzrayim because she was born. Now, the Ibn Ezra points out a remarkable thing. I think we may have mentioned this. We know that the Yidden were in Mitzrayim 210 years. We know that Moshe Rabbeinu was 80 years old when we left Mitzrayim. So Moshe Rabbeinu was born when how many years? No, this again. In other words, we left Mitzrayim after 210 years. Moshe Rabbeinu was born 80 years earlier. So how many years were we in Mitzrayim when Moshe Rabbeinu was born? So it's 210 minus 80. So that's 130. Is that correct? Yeah. So if Yocheved was born when they entered Mitzrayim, Yocheved was 130 years old when Moshe Rabbeinu was born. And of course, she was pretty old when Aaron was born too. Aaron was born 3 years earlier, but let's say even Moshe Rabbeinu, 130 years old. And she had her first child when she was 127 years old. So the Ibn Ezra asked the Kasha, the Torah makes such a big deal about the great miracle of Sarah Imenu, having a child at 90, and how it was a great miracle, and how it couldn't be understood. And yet the miracle of Yocheved was much, much greater.
Did they both look young? Because Rashi says that she looked young. She actually looked like a young woman. That was part of the niece. Did Sarah right. also the same?
Apparently yes. In other words, she changed into young. I mean, she looked old when before the malachim came. Yeah. But with the malach, acharei balosi haitzin liyedna, right, her flesh was restored. So the Ibn Ezra, the Ibn Ezra as a mafarish, often either differs with Chazal. There's a whole interesting issue about the legitimacy of doing that. But the Ibn Ezra had his own shita, as many Rishonim did, actually, that if it was not a matter of halacha, if it was just a matter of explaining, he felt he had a certain liberty to differ with Chazal. And the Ibn Ezra very much disagrees with Chazal on this idea, because if Yocheved was born, if she was number 70 and she was born Bein HaChomos, then her miracle should have been celebrated in the Torah, just as the miracle of Sarah was celebrated. This was even a greater miracle. So some want to say, well, when it happens the second time around, it isn't so impressive. Hashem already, in other words, Sarah Imenu broke the natural barrier, so to speak. Right? So at that point, it's like the 4-minute mile, right? The first guy who broke the 4-minute mile, Roger Bannister, a tremendous thing. Now, what is the record for mile now? Must be 2 minutes? What are they up to now? I mean, the people, you know, 4-minute mile is no big deal anymore, and people break it, etc. So, like, Sarah Imenu created, like, a miraculous hashva in the world. So other people, Yocheved, benefited from it and the like. Okay. But there's another point to be made here, and that is, in addition to the miracle of Yocheved's birth, the truth is all of Klal Yisrael experienced a miraculous birth in terms of the tremendous fertility. Right? Bnei Yisrael, Paru, Vayitritzu, from that 70. You know, former chief rabbi of Israel, who's now the rabbi of Tel Aviv, and whose son is the present chief rabbi of Israel, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau, who many actually would like to be the next president of Israel, of all things. Very nice man, and Talmud Chacham, but also he's gets along with people, so he is really a natural politician in many, many ways, and also a very ethical person. He's a Talmud Chacham, and so actually he wouldn't be. I can't imagine he'd want such a job, but he wouldn't be a bad president for Israel. But when he was Rav HaRashi, he once had occasion to visit Cuba, because there are Jews in Cuba. And he went to, so he had a 3-hour meeting with Castro. And if you ever
talked about this,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, so you heard him? Yeah.
That's right.
Now, if you ever know, you know, when you're in a conversation with Castro, you know, he talks. I mean, he can talk for 10 hours, you know, without stopping. This is a yadua about Castro. So he said, so the one thing Castro was fascinated in is Castro was aware of the fact that the Jews were 70. When they entered Egypt, and they left Egypt at around 3 million, because you could go with the 603,000 men from 20. So Castro knew this, you know. And Castro was fascinated about the birth rate. He kept on asking Rabbi Lau, so what's the demographic population rate? How do you get from 70, you know, X number of years? Rabbi Lau was making charts with them for like three hours. But apparently it's considered to be a miraculous rate. Chazal expressed it. Everybody gave birth to six. Some say 60 again, and those are guzmas in some ways, but there was a very, very large increase in fertility. 603,000. But the Ramban points out, when you look at the tribal breakdown, how much in each tribe, you see that Shevet Levi was the smallest of the tribes. Shevet Levi did not experience, apparently, the tremendous fertility of all the other Shvatim. And the Ramban says Shevet Levi were the only tzaddikim, really, because most of the Jewish people didn't practice Bris Milah. They were Ovdei Avodah Zorah. Remember, Ad Kedei Kach, that in Kriyas Yamsuf, the angels were saying, why bother to save them? Shevet Levi were the tzaddikim. They were the Ziknei Yisrael, the elders of Israel. They were the tzaddikim. They were the Shomrei Mesiris, whatever the Mesirah meant then exactly, of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. They did Bris Milah. So why should Shevet Levi be the smallest of the tribes? Why shouldn't they share the blessing of fertility? So the Ramban gives two very, very interesting answers. The Ramban says, answer number one is, maybe Shevet Levi did experience the same fertility as the other tribes. In other words, because we don't know exactly how many there were when they left Mitzrayim. We're just given how many there were when the Mishkan, right? The first number we're given as a tribe is Hakamas HaMishkan. And maybe since they were around the Aron and around the Mizbech and around the holy things, if you don't have the right kavanas, or you look where you're not supposed to look, you die. So maybe the small size of their population was not because they were small in Mitzrayim, but because they were Osek in such sacred holy things that if they didn't have the right kavanas, they died. In other words, they had a higher than normal mortality rate after they left Mitzrayim. That's one answer he gives. But the other answer he gives is also very interesting, and you're so distinct. He says, the Pasuk says, Kasher Yanu Oso, the more they were afflicted, the more they grew. The fertility was Hashem's bracha to protect and nurture Am Yisrael in its affliction. Shevet Levi was given an exemption. Shevet Levi were not abadim, they were not slaves. So the Ramban says, if they didn't share in the affliction of Am Yisrael, they weren't zeichel lebracha. So it's not that they had an abnormally low fertility rate. They had a regular fertility rate. The Jewish people, the other Jewish people, were given a higher rate. So you see that in life there are compensations, so to speak. That precisely because Am Yisrael was suffering, Hashem in His chesed gave them this extra bracha. Shevet Levi that was not nichlal in the shibut, they were not included in the servitude, were not included in the bracha of fertility. So these are the two terutzim the Rambam says. In other words, do we understand the small population to mean they had a lower fertility rate when they left Egypt, or does it mean they had a higher mortality rate once they were in the desert? Right? Those are the two pshatim of the Rambam. Yeah.
Why would Mitzrayim give the exemption to Shevet Levi like different
written, like, right. So it's interesting. I once saw a whole pshat from Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. Do you remember the end of Parshas Vayigash? Yosef institutes, when Yosef is still running Mitzrayim, Yosef institutes a land policy where in order for people to get seed during the years of famine, they would have to give up their land to Paro and then become tenant farmers, sharecroppers. And in that way, Yosef managed to create a communist or socialist state, where all of the land was owned by the government and the like. But it mentions that Yosef did not allow the land of the Kohanim, now this means the idolatrous priests, to be purchased, because they were entitled to be supported. Since they were entitled to be supported, therefore, they got seed and they got grain without giving up their land. Now, when you learn the Chumash, you might get the impression that this had been the pre-existing Egyptian policy. And that's the Pashup Shat. If Yaakov wants to learn, this was part of Yosef's enactment, that the priests, the clerical class, did not have to give up their land.
Was it a pre-existing rule?
That's where Rav Yaakov learns. It was not a pre-existing rule. Again, it's a Chiddush in Pshat.
Yeah.
So Rav Yaakov says, what was Yosef's cheshbon? Yosef knew that the Jewish people would be enslaved. But the basis of the enslavement was that nobody in Egypt owned any land. So as a result, Paro could enslave any group of population by saying, you're not going to eat unless. He wanted to be sure that the Talmidei Chachamim and the Tzaddikim of Am Yisrael would not be enslaved, so they continue to be teachers. Now, Yosef certainly couldn't get an exemption for Shevet Levi. So instead, Yosef got a clerical exemption for all clergy. And it was the private ownership of lands, as it were, that took away the legal leverage. In other words, the legal basis of enslavement was the fact that nobody could own any private property. But since the clerics were allowed to own private property, Paro would not be able to enslave them. So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky says that Yosef created the legal mechanism by which Shevet Levi could not be enslaved. I mean, it's a very interesting pshat. The only thing is, what bothers me a little bit is that dictators in the ancient world didn't necessarily observe legalities. Now, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky is kind of assuming, oh, there's not a legal basis, but the truth of the matter is, it's not so rachuk. You know, even Hitler, it's an amazing thing. If you look, if there's anything that doesn't seem to follow laws, is of course the Holocaust. But if you look, Hitler tried to play everything by some perverse book. It was really a very, very odd thing that everything had to be done with official orders. Things were drafted, proclamations, they passed laws, they wouldn't just kill a Jew, they had to, pass laws that said the procedures of execution and cremation and burning people. There is sometimes a concept that the way totalitarian, how do you convince an average German citizen? An average German was not, normally an evil person. He wouldn't come in and shoot his dog in the head or whatever it would be. So it's really a psychologically difficult problem. How do you have people who seem to be ordinary, decent people participate in these atrocities? Hitler himself, I mean, obviously some people you can see were crazy, they were psychotic, they were sociopath. But a lot of the Nazis, had you met them in ordinary life, some of them had Jewish friends before the war, had you met them in ordinary life, you would not have said, there's something, scary about them. It's really one of the most difficult questions of the Holocaust.
Doesn't Rabbi Elchanan say to that? Is this no God?
In Yiras Elokim, ultimately that's so.
Overnight,
that's very true. Without Yiras Hashem, anything can happen. But I just want to point out that one of the ways psychologically a person convinces himself it's okay is they go through a veneer, a ceremony of law. Well, everything was, you know, passed and there were laws and there were judges and there were courts. And this is sometimes a veneer, a pretense, or a mask that makes you, that convinces you, oh, no, we're just following the laws here,
Rabbi
following
friend,
orders.
My friend brings down a story.
Yeah.
From this rabbi who's from Ottawa, Ontario, and when he was a kid, and I think it was Kristallnacht, I think it was. Yeah. He was a boy in the theater in that city in Germany, and he found out that the Rebbe's his house was on fire. And he called the fire department, and the fire department chief said, "Yes, we have it on note. We know your house is on fire.
Yeah.
But the law in Germany is that if a Jew's house is on fire, we're not allowed to put it out. So it is a country of laws.
That's right.
Jurisdiction.
That's right. That's
but
right.
The laws are.
So you have to understand that there actually is a saying in English that the road to hell is paved with law. Because law gives a person, they have good intentions, another one, because law gives a person a sense, he's fooling himself, that, you know, I'm not a hefker person, I'm not a wild person, I'm not a crazy evil person. We are following laws and procedures and rules. So Mamela, I could hear perhaps Yaakov's point that if Paro didn't have his legal basis, Paro would be stuck. Actually, I'll tell you the truth, even with Achav you see this. Now that I think about it, King Achav, right? Achav was a big Russia. And Achav had a great desire for somebody's vineyard, Naboth. Right? So, now Achav is a Russia. Achav is an idolater. Achav, you know, does all the Averis in the Torah. But Achav can't figure out. The guy doesn't want to sell it to him. So Achav has to have a trial where there are witnesses that say that this guy cursed Hashem, and therefore this person is Chayav Misa, and this person is executed, and those who are executed, the property goes to the king. Why is Achav going through a false trial? Let him just, you know, let him just kill the guy. The answer is no. Achav wants to come across as a law-abiding citizen. Same thing with Stalin. A show trial. Stalin had a lot of enemies. So everybody was always put on trial. Now Stalin told the judges what they had to decide, and if they didn't decide that way, they would be killed. But they have to have a trial, and people read confessions, you know, I have said so and so. You see, this is going back to the idea that you need the veneer of legality. And the Russia seeks the facade. It looks good. So that's what Yaakov said, that even Paro needed a legal basis for enslavement. Okay, sorry again, we'll see you tomorrow. Yeah.